Okay, if you don't mind, let me go ahead and get started, please. Y'all don't mind, I'm gonna need to go ahead and get started. That's just like school.
It's worse, because these are adults.
And they don't care. Well, I don't know. I don't know. The same thing's true in high school. Okay, couple of quick announcements. Announcement number one. I am completely out of number two and three handouts again. I've given out all I had extra tonight. How many of you still need number two? All right, I need to run about 10 more. How many need number three? That was last week. Okay, if I run 10 more, I'll run 10 more again, and they'll be here next week. I have tonight's, and usual pattern is they will be available at the end. Now, tonight, I'm going to try to cover chapters 2 and 3 of the book of Revelation. I'm not going to be as extensive on this, to which y'all are going to say amen. In addition, if you've got questions tonight after I finish chapter 3, this is a good time to ask. Next week, my goal is to get, for you want to read ahead, 4, 5, and introduce the seals, which start in chapter 6. Now, I think I can get definitely through 4 and 5 next week. I think I can introduce the seals, but that's just basically where I'm hoping to get. Okay, with that in mind, tonight we're going to be looking at chapters 2 and 3. Opening chapter of the book of Revelation on 5 separate occasions mentions the 7 churches of Asia. So I thought it would be nice if you had an opportunity to have a map to look at, and I reproduce this map in the handouts so that you can take this home with you. First of all, John says he was in the island or on the island of Patmos. You will notice in, I think you can see it down here, Patmos is located some 40 miles off of the coast, away from the city of Ephesus to the southwest, and it is here in the Aegean Sea. This is where John is located. Now, with that in mind, you'll notice something that I think is sort of interesting. When you come to chapters 2 and 3, you come to this list of the 7 churches in order. And I just want you to notice, follow me, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. You notice how these follow a pattern? Okay. Briefly speaking, this is what a lot of scholars now know to be the Roman postal military road for the first century. Rome was noted for its roads. So, if you had a ship that came, and by the way, Ephesus was the area where most of the ships stopped. So, if you have a ship coming to Ephesus bearing mail, then they're going to be delivering that mail along the postal road, which happens to go from Ephesus to Smyrna to Pergamum to Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, and then back to Ephesus. So now then, knowing that, I want you to understand when you read 7 churches, there's nothing mystical about the order here. I read some people that say this is 7 types of churches. I can't tell you it's not 7 types of churches. But what I can tell you is there is absolutely nothing in Scripture that would indicate it's 7 types of churches. You can make it that if you want to, but you have to make it that in spite of Scripture. Some people say this is the 7 ages of church history. Make it that if you want to, but there's nothing in Scripture that would indicate that. It's a very simple explanation. All you have to do is to look. It's the way they delivered the mail. So let's not make something out of it that we don't have to make. Now, as you also notice this, there are 2 things that I want you to pay attention to as we're going to go through. And I'm going to do this a little differently tonight because, first of all, I'm just going to take you to these cities and let you see some things. And then after we've gone through all of the slides, then I'm going to come back and we're going to talk about each of the 7 cities and what's unique about it. Here are the 2 lessons, and there are only 2, and it's in your notes. First lesson you should get when you read the 7 churches' letters. Every one of them had something they were proud of in their city. Every one of them. And Jesus is saying, number two, that's not real. I'm the real thing. Okay? It's the same thing in all of the seven. They had something they were proud of. Jesus said, that's not real. I'm going to give you what's real. You understand that? You understand the letters to the seven churches. Okay, so with that in mind, let me just start our little place of step off here. And this is the island of Patmos. Actually, it is just a hill on the island of Patmos. I told you I was going to be a little more interactive tonight. What do you see when you look at the hill? By the way, this is typical of the other pictures of Patmos. What? Rock. Okay. This is barren. There's not anything that is there that would grab your attention. It's not a place where you got a lot of forest. It's not a place where you can grow a lot of crops. There are a few areas, of course, where you can do a little of that. But for the most part, it is a very barren rock island. Now, interestingly enough, it was a prison colony for the Romans. There's been some argument about this through the years, but I think the consensus of the evidence points to the fact that that was, in fact, what took place. And John does say, I was on the island of Patmos, and the historical evidence says he was shipped there basically as a result of his teaching of the gospel in order to be punished. So I think that shows you a little bit. Now, if you'll notice the second one, this is another picture of another area, some scrubs there, but nothing more than that. This is the area, if you'll notice on the bottom right, this is the area where John supposedly had his revelation. There's no way of knowing that for a fact, but this just gives you at least a little bit of an idea. And this is a better picture of it. Supposedly he was in a cave that you'll see. Well, I hope you can see it. Yeah, you can see it pretty well. Supposedly he was in this cave. Again, no way of knowing for sure. But he was on the island of Patmos, and at least you get an idea of what's taking place there. Okay, so we move from there to the city of Ephesus. This is a picture of probably the most noted building in the ancient city, the remains of the Library of Celsus. It is considered one of the really very fortunate pieces of architecture to still be standing because there are a lot of earthquakes in that region, and it's obviously undergone a lot in its history, but it would have been there during the time of Paul, and then there are a lot of other things that are there, a lot of ruins, but nothing that's quite as, I guess, something that would stand out as much as this, unless you talk about the theater itself. And this is the theater. This would be where Paul, for example, was put on trial. If you notice, there is a street that is running away from the theater that is running back toward the Aegean Sea. Ephesus is on the seacoast. That street ends, that's where the sea used to go to, but it has filled up and silted in over the years, and now it's just sort of a swampy area. The sea is back on toward those blue mountains in the background today. But this is the large amphitheater in Ephesus. This is where you have the people screaming out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," etc. Okay, this is a better view of the street. A lot of columns and sort of altars that are still lining it, still in enough condition that most people want to go there and look at it. It is one of the most widely visited spots in the city of Turkey. Now, it also had a very unique building there that was known as the Temple of Artemis or the Temple of Diana. This is an artist reconstruction of what they think it looked like. We're going to talk about it in more detail in a minute, but this gives you at least an idea of what people think. If you've been to Nashville to Centennial Park, you've seen the Parthenon. Put this in perspective, the Temple of Diana is four times the size of the Parthenon. And I think the Parthenon for that time was a pretty large building. So the pillars, by the way, are about 127 feet tall each. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. This is the only pillar that remains standing from the temple. And again, if you look at it, you'll see it's just been sort of pieced together because it had collapsed and they've just gradually reconstructed that one pillar. Everything else about the Temple of Diana is gone. We do know what it looked like to some degree because there are coins and artwork from the ancient world that show us what it looked like. All right, as we move from Ephesus, we move to the city of Smyrna. Smyrna is located on the coast too. It's on the Aegean. You can see that in the upper right-hand corner. And you'll notice that you're up on top of a mountain where that top picture is taken. That is called Mount Pagus. It is the key to the city of Smyrna. And in ancient times, this was where they had all of their temples. Some of the columns you can still see there. But anyway, most of the remains are completely obliterated because of the modern-day city of Izmir, which is located there. Okay, from there we go to the city of Pergamum. Now Pergamum is inland, and I want you again to notice the hill here. This is the top of an area where all of the temples of Pergamum were located. And you'll see down the side of a hill a theater. It's one of the steepest theaters in the ancient world. I think I would probably almost get a little sick looking down from there. But there are a number of temples that were there that have some very special meaning. We'll talk about them in a minute. This is now up on top, and you can look down, and you can tell how high you are just from looking at it. The trees there are the remains of an area that led to what was called the Temple of Zeus, our altar of Zeus, and I'll show you a little bit better picture of that in a minute. When the Muslims took over this part of the world, they tried to obliterate anything of historical value, sort of like ISIS is doing today. And they took all of that altar of Zeus and they rolled it down the hillsides. And it stayed there until the 19th century when German scientists went there and literally rebuilt that temple in the city of Berlin. We'll talk about that and show you another picture. This is the the theater. Look how steep the hill is. So, give you an idea. That's another idea. Okay. Again, you're on top of that hill. You can see some of the remains of the temples that were up there on top. Same thing basically there. Okay. Almost to the point where... Now, this is in the Museum of Pergamum that's located in Berlin. This is the rebuilt, reconstructed altar of Zeus that was in Pergamum. You see a portion of it here. You don't see all of it. This is one part of a major hall. If you go through that doors, you can see three doors there at the top. You can go through those three doors and into the back and into the second area of this. This gives you a little better perspective. The altar, what you saw, is in the front there, and then there's that huge back portico area and a lot of other things that surround it. We'll talk about the significance of this when we go through it in just a second. Go to Thyatira. This is the only picture I have of Thyatira. Thyatira is a city, modern city. They have literally covered up almost everything. But what you can find there are all sorts of pottery shards from the ancient city because it was a merchandising city. It was a place where trade guilds were located. And we'll go again and talk about that later. As you go a little bit further, you will come to a number of the other cities. This is Sardis. This is at the foot of the hill at Sardis. You notice all of them have hills. This is the gymnasium, still well preserved, and this gives you another idea of what's there. Now, in the background, you see this huge mountain. That is where the fortress of Sardis was located. It was up on top of the hill. You'll notice the cliffs are pretty steep. Now, down in the valley, they had all sorts of things. Most people lived down in the valley, but there were a lot of things that were up on top of the hill. We'll see about that too. Again, this is down in the valley looking up. This gives you a size idea of some of the columns that are there, close up of part of the hill. This is an even better close up of the hill. Notice the steep columns, not the steep columns, the steep cliffs. Okay, and then finally, that's your last picture of Sardis, and you can tell some of the wall that was on top of the mountain there. From there we go to Philadelphia. This is about all that remains there, another modern city on top of it, but these are the columns leading inside the temple, and there are a lot of inscriptions on that we'll notice. Again, just basically the same thing. Now we come to Laodicea. Laodicea was part of the Tri-Cities of Asia Minor. There are three of them located right there together. Colossae, Laodicea, and Hierapolis. Bottom right, you see the picture of the freshwater cold springs that flowed from Colossae. It was noted for its good cold mountain water. On this particular picture, what you're looking at is Hierapolis. These are also springs. These are hot water mineral springs. And when the minerals come out, of course, as the water comes down, it leaves those minerals, they crust over, and that's basically what you end up with. Okay, I've got several pictures because I think this is cool. Hot Springs, Arkansas has nothing on this. Okay, now obviously you run into a problem with Laodicea because they didn't have any water supply. They didn't have any cold water springs. They didn't have anything to get water. So the Romans built aqueducts. And on the top left, you see some of the pipes that they used. You'll also notice that they have all been just pretty much encrusted with those minerals. There's very little hole there for the water to go through near the end. But this is the aqueduct. These are some of the street remains in the city of Laodicea. Okay, that gives you the background. All right. Now in Revelation chapter 2, please, if you will. I'm not going to cover every verse because it's not necessary. To the angel of the church of Ephesus, write. Okay, so skip down to verse 2. You have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. Okay, the significance that I would give to this particular scripture is the fact that there were a lot of pretend apostles around during that time. Again, that's a strong reason to believe this is written in 69 and not in 96. Because in 96, the Apostle John is the only apostle left standing. And not only that, he is pretty much invalid. So there's not a lot of apostles running around in 96. But in 69, they were all over the place because you read about them. Yes? Oh, yeah, sorry. All right. Okay, so with that in mind, go down to verse 7. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Now, there's an obvious reference here to the book of Genesis. But remember, I told you there are two messages that are found to each of the churches. Message number one, you have something you're proud of. Message number two, Jesus says, I've got the real thing. So what is this talking about? First of all, what is it talking about when it says the tree of life here, or the paradise of God? Go back to the Temple of Diana. The Temple of Diana was an area of refuge. So if you were someone who got in trouble, you could go and you could go into the precincts of Diana and you were not supposed to be able to be touched. And that worked pretty well for most of the emperors, except, of course, for some. For Nero, it didn't work. Nero managed to get in, and we'll talk about how in just a second. But you see, surrounding this precinct, and it was a fairly large precinct, there was a grove of trees completely surrounding it. And they call those trees the trees of life. Because when you got inside, you were safe. You were in a refuge. Okay, so as you look at it, that sort of makes sense. There was a tree at the Temple of Diana that was also known in ancient times as a tree of life. So that is of interest as well. And then this entire area is what we call a park. It's an encircled park. And the Persian word for encircled park is paradise. So now then, the people of Ephesus were very proud of that great temple and the city or section of refuge, park of refuge, and what they call paradise and the trees of life. Now, Nero said, I can't go through this. And they said, no, you can't go through it. He said, okay. So he brought his engineers in and they chopped down all the trees. So after that, there were no trees that he had to go through. So he marched his army in and took whatever he wanted. Like I say, it didn't always work. And that's what Jesus is saying. I'm going to give you the real thing. And by the way, he wasn't the only one who did that. There were other Caesars later who did much the same thing. So the lessons of that first city, first church, pretty simple. Okay, I'm going to move pretty fast tonight. Go on down to the reference to the church in Smyrna. And specifically now, I would like for you to look at verse 10. You will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Okay, start with the crown of life. Number one, I showed you the picture of Mount Pegasus. And I told you, you know, all of those temples were around the top. and there was a wall that surrounded it about halfway up. If you were approaching Smyrna in those days from the sea, according to ancient records, what you would see is something that glistened like a crown. And so they call that the crown of Smyrna. In addition, they worshiped Dionysius, and they had a special holiday for Dionysius. We celebrate July the 4th, etc. They celebrated Dionysius' holiday. And everybody took fake crowns and wore them around the streets. Okay? Once again, notice the lessons. You're proud of all this, but I'm going to give you the real thing. This is not real. It won't last. And all the temples are pretty much gone from the top of Mount Pegasus, only ruins there. And all those crowns, well, they were worthless to begin with. Never had any value to anybody. So the crown of life, all of that fits exactly what Jesus said. Now, I want you just to stop and think. Had Jesus mixed what he said from Ephesus and Smyrna, would it make the same emphasis? No. I mean, we would understand a little bit about it, but when he said in regard to the paradise and tree of life to Ephesus, boy, those people knew immediately. When he's talking to the people of Smyrna and he uses the idea of crown of life, they know immediately what he's talking about. So he's literally picking and choosing. Okay, in addition to that, you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Smyrna was noted for the gladiatorial games that took place where people fought to the death. There is one reference that has been found from ancient times that said the people of Smyrna had a unique tradition. Now, if you've seen The Gladiator, you know the gladiators literally fought to the death, okay? And it was very tiring. But the people of Smyrna said, if you're strong enough and you can go into the arena 10 days in a row and come out the winner, we'll give you your freedom. I find that interesting because when he talks to Smyrna, he says, you will have tribulation for 10 days. People in Smyrna understood that, knew exactly what he was talking about. Okay, down to Pergamum, and this is a little bit further down, and he references this by saying in verse 13, you dwell where Satan's throne is. Okay, you have seen Satan's throne, the temple to Zeus. Okay, this is the center of a lot of cultic worship during that time. You might find it interesting that in the period right before the Second World War, Adolf Hitler visited that museum almost daily in Berlin. He was absolutely enamored with the story there. You probably heard the story of the spear. You know what I'm talking about? Some of you have, some of you haven't. Supposedly the spear that thrust into Jesus' side survived. Of course, that's just folklore. But anyway, they had one of those in the temple at Pergamum, the Museum of Pergamum in Berlin. And Hitler was impressed with that. Okay, this is where Satan, that fits. People understood exactly what they were saying. And then he says, if you overcome, I'm down in verse 17, I will give you of the hidden manna to eat. Pergamum was noted for having withstood a siege by hiding some food behind their walls that allowed them to withstand a siege. I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name. And again, two things about this. Pergamum was the judicial center of that area. And you saw that arena. They would go there and they would have their trials. The freedmen of the city would go in and they would vote. They were given a number of stones, white or black. And if you wanted to vote for someone's conviction, you dropped a black stone in the barrel. If you wanted to vote for their acquittal, you dropped in a white stone. Okay, I'll give you a white stone. All right, now in addition to that, it says it's going to have a name written on it. In the city of Pergamum, when you were actually acquitted, they would write freed man on the stone and give you that so that you could take it around showing that you had been cleared of your sins or of your crimes. And again, that fits perfectly in regard to the city of Pergamum. Let's go on a little bit further. Let's go down to Thyatira, verse 27. Basically, one of the references here, they will be dashed to pieces like the potter's vessels. Again, as you look at that, you saw all of the things that were there. Don't have a whole lot to say about that, except there were a lot of pottery places there. Okay, we'll move on now to the city of Sardis. And city of Sardis is in chapter 3, and it opens up. You have a name that you are alive, but you're dead. Be watchful. If you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief, and you will not know what hour until I come upon you. Okay. History of Sardis. People there immediately understood. You saw those big cliffs. You know where those walls were at the top. And in order to get in, there's really only one way in. There was that opening at the front that was very well defended. You didn't take an army up the side. Or did you? Yes, you did. Two times in its history, people of Sardis were defeated in battle because they didn't watch their backside. That cliff and the walls up on top of it. First is the time of the Persians. Persian army came in, and King Croesus, one of the most noted of all ancient kings of Lydia, the man who supposedly had a golden touch. You get the story of Midas from King Croesus. All right, and he was up there, locked up on top, and waiting for springtime because he hired his armies, and he was just waiting for them to come and drive the Persians off. And he thought, nobody can get in here. Well, one night, late afternoon, there was a Lydian soldier up on top of that cliff, and he dropped his helmet. He didn't realize that there were Persian spies out there. He should have, but he didn't. What he did was, there was a little pathway down the side of that cliff, and he worked his way down that pathway, reclaimed his helmet, went back up and into a secret door. Persians saw it. So they sent up a party that got into that secret door at night, sort of like the Trojan horse story, and they were able to defeat King Croesus and the people that were inside. And that happened a second time a little bit later because they didn't watch. So when Jesus says to them, be watchful, those people knew exactly what he was talking about. It made sense to them because they were people that had actually gone through that. Okay. In addition, go down to verse 5. He says, I will not blot out his name from the book of life. Again, something that is really sort of unique in regard to this. The people in the city of Sardis had what they call a citizenry list. And they called it those who are in the book of life. I mean, it made sense to them. If you were a living citizen, you were in that list. Okay, and that's what Jesus is saying. All right, go down to verse 7 and we come to Philadelphia. He who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts and shuts no one opens. I have set before you an open door. Okay, first of all, the key of David, opening and shutting. The number one Roman god, patron god of the city of Philadelphia was Janus. And Janus is pictured as having two faces, one of which looks both ways. He was known in Roman mythology as the one who opens and shuts. And that was the patron god of the city of Philadelphia. Now, in addition to that, the city of Philadelphia was located right on the gateway that led into Asia Minor's interior. And everybody that was going east would go through the city of Philadelphia unless you were going along the coastline, because there was a path that you could go through there. And so they were noted for being the door to Asia Minor. And again, Jesus uses that very terminology when he is talking to the people of Philadelphia. And he's saying, I'm going to give you the real thing. Now, last we come to the city of, well, not, let's go down to verse 11 real quickly here. Let's go back to verse 10. I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world. I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. A couple of really neat things here. First of all, Philadelphia is being told, you're not going to have to go through the tribulation. When Nero launched his attacks on Christianity, when Domitian launched his attacks, and Trajan and others, Philadelphia was never touched. The early Christian records say for some reason, where they were located, it just spared them. That's exactly what Jesus said was going to happen, and it literally happened. And then he says, I will make him a temple of my God, a pillar in the temple. He shall go out no more. First, he shall go out no more. This is an area where they had a lot of earthquakes. In fact, in ancient times, you have writers that talk about the region and city of Philadelphia having so many earthquakes that people were afraid to go inside. They're afraid the buildings are going to collapse on top of them. In 61 AD, which is about 8 years, 7 or 8 years before the book is written, you had one of the most devastating earthquakes in that region. And the city of Philadelphia, they did not go back inside that city in most of the buildings for what is estimated to be 3 or 4 years. But what Jesus says, I'm going to let you be a part of my temple. And by the way, a lot of temples collapsed in that earthquake. He says, I'm going to make you a pillar in my temple, and you won't have to go back out. You can stay inside. See the illusion of what's there? Again, it's absolutely perfect for the people in the city of Philadelphia. Okay, let's go down to verse 14 and my favorite, the Laodiceans, and you probably know what's coming here. Famous thing about the Laodiceans is you are neither cold nor hot. Because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth. You see the illusion already? You remember the pictures? What's the illusion here? In Colossae, what kind of water? Cold mineral, cold water, and Hierapolis mineral hot springs. So they built aqueducts from both of them, from Colossae and from Hierapolis, and they met together right outside of Laodicea. So you have hot water and cold water, and it mixes together, and it becomes lukewarm. And it also has a horrible taste, and so all that the people of Laodicea basically could do with the water, they had to boil it in addition, but basically all they could do with it is use it to wash clothes and things. It was very difficult to drink. You ever been to Florida and had some of their mineral water? You like it? I don't. Maybe some of you do, but at any rate, I find that absolutely fascinating. Jesus is perfectly in line in every one of them. I'm going to skip past one for the next one. It says, buy from me gold refined in the fire. We have a lot of gold coins from the city of Laodicea. It was known as the Wall Street of Asia. There were gold refineries there. It was known as being so rich that when that 61 AD earthquake hit, Caesar said, I will remit your taxes. I'll help you. And the people of Laodicea literally said, thank you, we don't need anything. I mean, it's recorded in the historical documents what they said. Again, Jesus is right on line here. Even with the eye salve that you read about, there was a place there that manufactured eye salve for that time. It's in the ancient documents. Again, look at it real carefully and just summarize it. Two lessons, all you have to remember. Lesson number one, you people in all of these cities are proud of some things. And he's very specific about each city, and it fit every city uniquely. And then he says, I'm going to give you the real thing that's not real. In other words, you want real water, like living water, you come to me. You don't taste these other kind of waters. If you want a real crown, you come to me. I'll give you the real crown, not a makeshift crown. If you want to be someone who can open and close doors of opportunity, come to me. I'll give you the real opportunity to do that, and I'll protect you while you're doing that, while you're becoming that door into the interior of Asia Minor. So every one of them fits. It's a simple pattern. It's easy to remember. Now, I have deliberately shot through this tonight, and all of the handouts have a lot more information. You can go through and look at them when you get home. What questions do you have about this? Don't be afraid to ask. If I don't know, I'll go look up the answer and try to find it. Okay, some of you said you wanted to ask questions, so I'm giving you a chance. It doesn't have to be about 2 and 3. It can be about chapter 1, any of the things that we talked about earlier. Because once I get launched into next week, I'm going to be rolling right along, and it's going to be hard for me to stop for a lot of discussion after that. Thank you.
This goes way back.
That's okay.
One of the readings that we had, the sub-readings of what we're doing, was in Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
There was a significance. What was the significance for the 45-day differential detailed in Daniel? It was 12, 11, 12, I believe. Mm-hmm. You were good if you were so many days, and it was even better if it was 45 more days. What was the significance in those 45 days?
All right, let me do a couple of things first before I get to that. Because in order to understand that, you really need to understand Daniel 7, 13, and 14 first, and then Daniel 9, 24 to 27, and then we'll get to that. Okay, first in Daniel chapter 7, 13 and 14, you have a vision that Daniel is having, and he says, I was having this dream, and I saw one like the Son of Man coming into the presence of God to receive a kingdom. Okay? Now, what is going on in that particular, and that was part of the... Is this for you? Well, it is 7:15. Well, Larry, I will try my best. I'm sorry. Let me finish at least 7:13 and 14. Did you notice it says the Son of Man was going into heaven to receive his kingdom? And he wasn't coming down to earth to receive a kingdom on earth? I hope you noticed that. Okay, that's very, very important. And then in Daniel chapter 9, you have that famous prophecy of the 70 weeks, which ultimately says, I'm going to give you a beginning date and an ending date of prophecy. I'm going to tell you how much time in between. On that final day, the Messiah is going to be cut off, and you can go back and trace it, and it happened, I mean, absolutely on the very day, 173,880-day difference between the two. So now then, when we get to the 45 days, and actually the 1,260 days, then the 45 days becomes a whole lot easier. Okay, and I will start with that next week.